This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Laura Ritchie could have chosen an easier path. Her great-great-grandfather invented the champagne of North Carolina soft drinks, Cheerwine. It became a family business. Laura's dad worked for the company, as did many of her relatives. But growing up in Salisbury, North Carolina, Laura wanted to escape. Not that she wasn't happy with her home or her family's success, but she wanted something different. Specifically, she wanted to be an artist. But it wasn't until she went to Florence, Italy, that she started to understand just how she might make that dream happen. What she learned on that trip led her to co-found a commission-free art gallery. It's called the Carrick Modern Art, and it's here in Durham. And it's a community-funded space that allows artists the freedom to practice their craft without worrying so much about the funding. Laura Ritchie joins us now on the program. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Hi, Frank. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the Carrick Modern. What is it? What's the concept?
Yeah, the Carrick Modern Art is a zero commission space right here in downtown Durham. It's on Parrish Street above Loaf Bakery. And it's dedicated to providing zero commission exhibit opportunities to artists so that they have a chance to really connect with their community.
And what's the difference? I mean, obviously, then 100% of the proceeds go to them.
100% of the proceeds go to them, yes. And this was all started back in 2010. John Windelbow, who's a Durham artist, created the Durham Sculpture Project. And I started working for him on that. And a lot of the founding principles, this idea of fast-paced, fluid exhibit opportunities and sort of an art incubator where cross-pollination can happen across different art forms, all sort of grew out of that. And we opened the space together in late 2011.
The Carrick Modern Art itself is a gallery. It's not a workspace, right?
It is a gallery, but artists do work there occasionally. Part of this sense of community ownership that we're trying to create is we leave it open during installation. So while the artist isn't necessarily creating the work in the space, the public has the chance to also see their creative process while they're putting together their exhibit.
Now, the chance to show my work in a commission-free space would be one I would jump at. So I imagine there's a fair amount of competition to get in, right?
There are a lot of people who want to show with us now. In 2012, we were so new that everything was sort of set up just in a conversation with me and a look at the artist's work. But in 2013, we are reviewing proposals as they come in, and we've put together a group of past Carrick artists to help us review those and choose who gets to show in the space.
Now, you are on the second floor, so it's not that you don't have an attractive storefront. It is Loaf, and so there's
right.
bread.
There's bread.
The smell of
there's
fresh
bread.
Baked goods wafting from the building, but we can't really see your work. Now, has that proved a challenge just to get people to know where you are and what's going on?
It has been a challenge, and at the very beginning, when it was just John and I trying to tell people about what we were doing, one of us would stand down on the street and literally pull people off the sidewalk to come upstairs while the other person was upstairs making sure everyone knew that we were run solely on donations and we really needed the community support to keep it going.
It's great. It's like the burlesque shows in New Orleans. You got somebody down there and somebody
right,
up there
right.
with a box collecting,
the crowd.
collecting dough, the crowd on Paris Street, which is growing, I suppose.
It is. It's really growing. That has changed so much because we actually opened as a gallery before Loaf opened their doors as a storefront. They were baking in that space, but there weren't a lot of other storefronts on Parrish Street a year and a half ago.
Well, I think that's what they said. How cool would it be to bake bread right under an art gallery?
Oh, I certainly can't take credit for that.
The smell of oils and acrylics wafting into the... No, I don't
yeah.
think that's how it kind of... So how does curation work? How do you curate then? Because as you said, I mean, artists want to get in there. So,
yeah,
so how do you choose?
That's a great question. And that's been something that I've had to learn how to navigate because the Carrick has self-curated shows. So the artists choose how they want their work to be displayed. The artist is in complete control of all aspects of their exhibit. They receive a set of keys to the space while their work is up, and it becomes their space as much as it remains ours. So my job has become more about just helping them helping them work out the process of installation and helping facilitate a conversation between the community and the artist while the work is up.
The community is important because it's community funded. How has that worked out? You have to have people donate.
Yep, we have to have people donate. So like many new young businesses popping up around Durham and the Triangle, we used Kickstarter in November of 2011, and we raised $12,000 in 6 weeks from about 200 donors who believed in what we were doing. And we were able to sort of pay our rent for 2012 in advance. And we've now done the same thing for 2013 through a fundraiser we had back in October.
Well, so you're paid all the way through this year, the end of this year.
For rent, yes.
For rent, but then you have to, you're not paying yourself.
No, I'm not. So I'm not paying myself yet.
What do you do to keep your doors open?
Well, I also work at the Durham Art Guild. I'm the education and outreach coordinator there, and I'm an art teacher too. And I also have a really great group of volunteers who help split the time in just keeping the Carrick open for visitors to come through.
You're somewhere around 24 years old,
yes.
Relatively young to be opening a gallery, particularly one that's, I think, isn't it? What made you decide to do this, one that was not going to make you a living for in the foreseeable future?
Yeah. Well, wanting to own and run an art space has been a dream of mine for a very long time. But this particular model completely grew out of the inspiration that I saw in John Windelboe's Durham Sculpture Project. He became kind of a mentor for me and really changed. I mean, he was really challenging everything I knew and I think the broader community knew about art spaces and funding them and just the dynamic of a community's involvement with an artist's work. And I really got behind it. It fit so perfectly with my interest in the interaction that happens between individuals in an art space.
What's the difference? Just on the financial side, I want to get to this collaboration and sort of getting the community to be excited about something they've invested in. That's an important part. I want to get to that in a minute. But the financial side, for the artist, how much of a difference does it make to be selling art on commission with, you know, in a space? So there are artists there, people can see it, and yeah, a certain percentage goes to the space that we've housed it in. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound like a bad deal.
No, not at all.
And how much of an impediment is that? What changes? How much does it change for artists when they get to keep it all?
That's a great question. I think that, you know, we certainly want artists to profit from sales that they make in the Carrick, but a big part of our motivation in removing the commercial pressure of taking a commission is allowing complete creative freedom on the part of the artist. So they don't have to create work that will sell because we, the gallery, are not expecting that in exchange. And it also allows artists to show work in our space that can't be sold or owned. So site-specific installations, art that is perishable, just work that's about the experience and the artist's vision rather than an object that can be owned.
What does that do you think, for the community and for the artist to be able to create that? And because you have now investors, in a sense, people who've donated to Kickstarter, people who've been to the Carrick and the Carrick Modern, seen exhibits and dropped some money in the bucket. They're investors. So I'm going to ask a different question. What are they expecting? What are your investors, your donors expecting?
I think they're investing in a story. They're investing in the interactions that that happen in a space that has poetry and music and visual art and dance all at the same time. And it's a group of thinkers. It's about creative ideas and the overlap that happens when you put people like that in the same space.
I know that part of the use, you explained that part of this had to do with watching John's sculpture project unfold and to see the amount of creativity that sort of grew around that. But also, I understand you had an experience in Florence that was part of that drove part of this decision.
Yeah, well, so I went to school at UNC Chapel Hill and I was a studio art and art history major there. But, you know, I grew up in North Carolina. I grew up 2 hours from UNC. So while that was a change for me, just moving from my parents' home to a university setting, I was still very much involved in a similar community that I had been involved in for my entire life. So I studied abroad in Florence, Italy at an art school. And I was anonymous. I mean, it was 2008, so Italians wanted to know where I was from and who I was voting for. And my peers wanted to know what my art looked like. And that was it. There was nothing else that defined me. So I was in a place where I was forced to define, you know, my identity just as an adult, my identity as an artist. And I was also fell in love with art spaces there. I was in an art history course where we actually traveled to the museums and had our Renaissance art history lesson in front of the work of art. And that was such a drastic change from my experience at UNC, sitting in a big lecture hall, looking at slides of objects on a giant screen.
But experience for what? About was it the power of art, the power of, I mean, curation? And here in this case, the way that art is curated is, I mean, a lot of time and attention goes to that as well.
Yes, that was the first time I noticed the space and what the space did for the art and what the curating did for the art and my experience as a viewer. And I came back to UNC feeling like that's where I needed to be. I needed to work with art spaces and in art spaces.
Well, we'll talk more about that trip and a little bit more about the biography of Laura Ritchie and how she came to be a co-founder of the Carrick Modern Art in Durham as our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today talking with Laura Ritchie, co-founder of the Carrick Modern Art in Durham. And Laura, you said you grew up in Salisbury, North Carolina, a pretty small town. What was that like?
Yeah, it was wonderful and it was also suffocating. Mm-hmm. Salisbury, it has about 30,000 people, but it sometimes feels like about 20. It just has that small town feel. People know each other and... So I grew up with a really amazingly strong and supportive network of people, which included my family. But I also, as soon as I started to become an adult and have my own opinions and thoughts, you know, it was just itching to get out.
To get out. Well, your great-great-grandfather invented cheer wine.
He did, and he did that in Salisbury. That's a big part of my family's history, and I'm certainly proud of them for the work they've done to create that.
And it was a family business, so your father worked there?
Yep, it still is a family business. He did work there for all of my childhood. But in 2006, he made the decision to leave the company. I think it served him very well and he loved what he did there, but he was just ready for something else. And so he just has an incredible work ethic. He's an inspiring human being. Of course, I'm biased, but him making that change at such a late time in life really just underlined the way that both of my parents just raised me to follow my dreams, my heart.
Would change to work in community service, right?
Yeah. Yeah, essentially. Mm-hmm.
And you saw that, and so it's a mid-career. He's probably making pretty good money. What was it like for you to be sort of part of that family in a town that small, the Cheerwine family?
There were struggles at times. That was certainly something that most people knew because, you know, small town, and that's kind of Salisbury's little claim to fame. I was very aware of that, but it wasn't a part of my immediate family life. You know, it was my dad's job, and he came home and he wanted to talk about what I learned in school that day and what I was interested in and, help show me how to get there.
What were you interested in?
Art. It was art. It was always art.
Wow. What do you remember? Was there a moment for you, an inspirational moment, or is just always something you wanted to do?
Miss Cindy's messy art class at Waterworks Visual Art Center in Salisbury. I don't even know if I was in elementary school yet, but she was just so incredible. And she ended up being a recurring figure for me. She ended up being my high school art teacher as well. And she's really the person that underlined the fact that I could pursue this as a career path.
Well, what was going on in the messy art class?
Finger painting. I mean, literally. Yeah. It was just finger painting. But it was so much fun. And it was such a learning experience. And it always comes back to these connections for me. I think these really beautiful human connections happen over art.
So it was probably less your creations than Miss Cindy's passion, would you
yeah,
say?
Yeah, it was probably her yeah. passion.
And yeah. then again in high school, did she recognize, did she encourage you to pursue art?
She did. She did. And up until that point, it was just sort of a hobby for me. I mean, my parents were very supportive in that, and I never felt like I had to take any particular career path based on what they wanted for me. But she really was the one who said, you know, you could actually do this. And I heard her.
What did you think this was? What was art for you in high school?
I wanted to be an artist, but I didn't really know what that meant at the time. You know, I liked to draw, I liked to paint, all those sort of basic things, that basic skill set. And it wasn't really about expressing any particular concept. It was more just about aesthetic beauty at the time.
So people were reacting to your stuff. You're making mm-hmm. things look nice. They say it looks good. You want to keep doing that.
Right, right.
You pursue it. Did you? You took art at Carolina?
Yep. I got a BFA there in 2010. So I studied studio art and art history. But it wasn't until I returned from that trip to Italy and had Juan Logan as a professor that I really started taking that seriously. He's the one who said, you know, who are your friends that make art? You know, who's your favorite living artist? When's the last time you went to a gallery? And this was my second semester of my junior year of college, and I'm an art major, and I couldn't answer those questions. And it really motivated me to, okay, like if I'm going to do this, this is part of who I am, and I need to make this a part of my daily life.
Why did you think that? I mean, you're making these pretty pictures. People are liking them. That's art for you. Mm-hmm. You're happy. And then this question that deeply troubles you, who mm-hmm. do you know who's an artist? Who do you hang out with and you can't answer? Why is that troubling?
Well, that was paired with actually another course that I was taking. It was Carrie Levine's contemporary art course. And I'm looking at work made by living artists, which is new. You know, I had spent all this time studying Renaissance art, all this work by people who are dead. And I'm taking this art history course and feeling totally inspired by the voices of people who are not very much older than me, who are making work now. And that paired with Juan's question to me really made it seem like just these pretty pictures I was making were inadequate. It wasn't satisfying anymore.
What would satisfy you? Then what changed? What did you think art should be now that you have had your whole notion upset?
Well, I didn't know. So I made it a point to find out. So I immediately ran over to the Ackland Art Museum and talked to them about an internship and started an internship in their education department. And I also went beyond the university, gasp, and went to the Art Center in Carrboro. And I started volunteering there and very quickly was given the position of gallery coordinator. And I worked there for the next 2 years organizing exhibits in their two art spaces.
So in this process, what's changing for you and your ideas about what art is from the point of view of the artist, the creator?
Mm-hmm. It became about, it was about the artist's vision. This goes back to that being defined by what other people expected of me. Like I was making art for my professors. I was waiting for an assignment and I was making something that was a response to their assignment. It wasn't about my own voice. I hadn't figured out what that was yet. And so in working at the Art Center and at the Ackland, I was exposed to all of these artists who are just making things because they have to make it, because they have something to say. And in that process, I actually found it more satisfying to facilitate that for them and sort of in that goes into curating and directing right. art spaces than it was for me to make the work.
It's interesting. And creating an art space like, mm-hmm. like the Carrick Modern.
Right.
So, but it's also fascinating that the way that the progress of this thing. So you're living in Salisbury. It's fine. The family's mm-hmm. good. Nobody's pressuring you to stay at Cheerwine. So off you go. And you think that's my escape. And then, oh, no, I'm still doing things to please other people.
Right.
What a great discovery that is. Right. And then you realize that it's not my own making art, but facilitating other people to make their own. What was your vision, though? Did you decide that there was something or body of things that you needed to express?
I knew. Wait, in terms of my visual art or in
yeah,
terms of this
art.
Facilitating?
Well, start there. And then it obviously becomes.
Yeah. So my visual art, I started delving into my family's history. So, I mean, there's a theme even now in this conversation about, you know, who am I? What do I have to say? How does my family's history affect who I am? So I started doing research into that. I started looking into my mom's side of the family because I was so oversaturated with my dad's side story because of where I grew up, and his whole family lives there in Salisbury, and that's where Tier 1's headquarters are. And so I started looking into her side of things too, and the project ended up really not being about them at all, and it was really just about me. But yeah, it was about identity.
It's always about you, Laura. Always about you. So you're developing this idea, and now to talk about the actual production of turning this idea into a reality. We're going to make an art space, and we're not going to know how to pay for it. You and John decide this will be a good idea.
We decided that. And from the beginning, he was very adamant about being sure that the community had ownership over the project and the space. And so for the first several months, you know, the Durham Sculpture Project set in motion the funds to get the space. But in terms of paying the rent, the first 4 months, we're putting together shows, we're inviting people in, and we're literally raising our rent for the next month at those events. We had an event every single weekend. And so we're, you know, taking in as much, you know, ones and fives and 20s, if we're lucky, as we can. And we were able to pay to keep it going. And then we decided to have the Kickstarter campaign, and the response from that is really what gave us the confidence to, you know, okay, this is a business, we're doing this. I became the director at that time, and yeah.
Tell us about some of the shows and installations you've had.
Oh, we've had so many fabulous ones. We've had 40 solo group exhibits just in 2012, which is a super fast pace, not to mention countless art performances like poetry and music and dance and film. One of my favorite, it's hard to talk about favorites because I really love all of them. I form friendships with all of these artists who come through the space. It's a very almost intimate experience to walk through that process with them. But I think one great example is Sarah Goetz. She did an installation called Just Between Us back in June. It was her first solo show. She was just out of Duke undergrad. And she installed this incredible paper installation that took up most of the gallery. It was like this big tornado looking thing. It was much more poetic than that, but it was beautiful. And it was paired with her paintings. It was also paired with a video piece. And she really understood how to use the Carrick. I mean, you get complete creative control over 1,200 square feet. So she used all of that space. And that opportunity led to several others since then. I mean, it directly led to an exhibit at the Art Center. She participated in Windows on Chapel Hill. So I love seeing artists get their start, because we are meant to be a platform of sorts. And then there have also been artists who are much more established who have also really benefited from our model. You recently had Jim Lee on your show.
Yeah.
His exhibit Spectives was incredible. Included even this sort of fictional character that he created called the Rock Ness Monster, which was so convincing that some of our viewers had to ask if it was a real thing. But so for somebody like Jim, who's much further along in his career, you know, he executed that with such grace. He knew exactly how he wanted to lay things out, how he wanted it to be received. But he benefited from it. I mean, he's still selling pieces from exposure that he gained at that show a couple of months ago.
Do all artists have the same feel for how to display their art? I mean, it's one thing to create it, and then quite another to make it look good.
It's completely different. Some artists come in and know exactly the way they want it to be, and some artists don't have a clue. You know, they understand how to make the work, and they've never had the opportunity to think about how they want it to be displayed. So I actually get pretty excited in those moments because I really enjoy that process. I love helping artists lay out their work and talking through the experience and the process. But yeah, it's completely different from one to the next.
I can imagine too that some of those artists have seen their work on display and it's maybe changed the way they see their own work. Has that happened?
That has happened. And because the Carrick is such an open forum sort of model, they're getting a lot of very real feedback. I mean, they're talking directly to the people that are experiencing their work, which I think often doesn't happen in art spaces. Often it's this sort of sterile environment and everybody's whispering and nobody's talking to each other and maybe the artist isn't there. And so the artist has to be completely involved in order to have a successful show in our space, because they have to do it.
This gets us to this community investment part of it. The difference that I might feel as a patron of the arts, someone who goes to the Carrick to have this experience. And I'm also an investor. I put some money into this thing, and money takes on a whole different quality. Mm-hmm. I haven't commodified the art. I'm not going to own it. Right. I've promoted it in mm-hmm. a way, and it just seems to me that it changes my relationship with art, my community, my relationship with money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you become a part of something. Ownership is a huge part of our mission. I mean, we want the community to feel ownership and be empowered by that, and we also want the artists to feel ownership over the space and the work. It's just about becoming part of an experience.
You had an exhibit there, I know, because we had her on, Saba Bernard,
yes.
And the Technicolor Muslima.
Uh-huh.
How did that go over? Because we had her on, we talked about it, but then mm-hmm. off she went.
It was wonderful. She got a great response. It looked beautiful in the space. She was able to have several of the women who were depicted in her portraits actually come and participate in interviews and talk to visitors. And I think that, well, I know that now she's working on another body of work that sort of jumped off from that experience. And so it's great to follow these artists too and watch their career unfold and see what was sparked in our space.
Sparked because you can have a conversation. And so mm-hmm. often art may be overtly political, and there were certainly political themes in that one, sometimes not, but at least you begin to realize how many possibilities there are when you see a work of art. It opens the imagination. But all of it allows people to engage in conversation, whether
right.
it's political or not. And mm-hmm. then those conversations go off, and we're all enriched, the artist as well as the people who went to see it. But I want to know more about the art history part, studying art, because mm-hmm. it seems to me that there's I just read a review recently where an artist complained about the way art is taught, mm-hmm. that art history very often suggests that one art movement led to another, and these were the, mm-hmm. the sort of the foundation of another. And it doesn't always allow us to allow the art for its own sake,
right.
not as a stepping stone to another form of art or another school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and I think that art history, I mean, it's hard to learn, you know, something as broad as art history without some sort of narrative created that's chronological. But I do think the collaboration that has happened among artists forever is left out of that story often, and the overlaps and the gray areas and how, you know, it wasn't just this movement and then it suddenly became this movement. I mean, there was a huge process in between, too. The art objects become like a stepping stone or a point on the timeline in this art historical narrative. And you're not really thinking about the piece themselves or the piece itself or the artists themselves.
Right, yeah. And I think that word conversation is key, because in conversations things go forward and backward and they
right.
go up and down. They go on wild tangents. And unfortunately, if you're going to put a book together, you really want to make a line.
Right.
And you want to make points along the way.
Yeah.
And you want to make sure the dots are fairly well connected.
Right, but that's not really how things progress. Yeah. It's all everything's on top of everything else. And it's the process itself is so beautiful. And I think that is what's left out of the art history textbooks often.
What is what's been the biggest surprise for you so far in a year and a half now, right?
Yeah. The support. I have been just so overwhelmed by the support that John and I have received in this endeavor. People come. They show up. They show up for our events. And they are continuing to give their time and their thought and their money to keep us going. And so I was pretty new to the Durham community when I became a part of this project. And it's just
Are they the same people who are coming? Are you seeing new people?
No. There are some sort of Carrick regulars, some familiar faces that come just because they like what happens in the space. But each artist brings his or her own audience. So there's new faces every single week because they've come to see that particular show.
On the State of Things today, my guest is Laura Ritchie. She's co-founder of the Carrick Modern Art in Durham. We're going to continue our conversation about art and about the influence it has on our community, and talk about the general the influence that art has had in the Triangle and the growth of the creative class here in the Triangle when my conversation with Laura Ritchie continues on the State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Laura Ritchie, co-founder of the Carrick Modern Art in Durham, a gallery that you founded with John, co-founded with John Wendelboe. The Carrick, tell us, because that's a 15th century sailing ship, is it not?
It is. Good for you.
Well,
you did your research.
Wikipedia is wonderful, isn't
it? Yeah. So a Carrick was a way for explorers to discover a whole new world. So in that metaphor, we're a platform for creative exploration.
Also a vehicle for capitalist imperialism.
Right.
Just pointing it out.
Right. Thank you.
Well, let's talk more about this model, about people giving, because we do this here, and I want to talk sort of about the politics. I find it fascinating. Here at Public Radio, we do this thing. We get people to pay for something that's free.
Right.
And you're essentially going to do the same thing. It's up there. You can come and see it. We'd like you to pay for it. People do that in public radio, honestly, because they understand the value of it.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it, I assume, at the Carrick Modern for the same reason. It also feeds into this argument, and it becomes a kind of political tussle, right? Because there's this argument that conservatives will make that say, why are you taxing people? This is not a public good. If the public wants it, they should pay for it, and let's just do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Kickstarter, crowdfunding seems to be doing that way, and we're all kind of happy with that model. Maybe it's a good one.
It does seem to be working for us, and that's been important from the beginning. We want to be sure that we are providing something that the community actually wants. Our success is completely dependent upon community participation. That's artists and viewers, and people who are willing to donate to a particular project, I think, feel that sense of investment and choose to continue to be involved.
A couple of risks along the way. It all sounds good and it does work well. And it is wonderful when you see it work. People
mm-hmm.
chip in for the thing they want to happen, and it does. Is there a danger that artists begin to play to the crowd? And so they're not expressing themselves, but they're looking for what's going to get the biggest bump.
I think maybe that happens in gallery models that are based on commission, because we pay our rent before the year has even started. We have paid our rent for 2013. No one who gave money to us for 2013 knew what art would be shown in our space. They're just trusting. They're trusting what happens in the space. They're trusting the artists that will show with us in advance. So, yeah, it's about trust.
And the whole idea of sort of creating any kind of government institutions, whether it's education or support for the arts, is that these things are a public good.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this public institution called government that in one way or another mediates the flow of money and the exchange of business. Are we moving to a new model? Is this it? This is the way the public really does get to express itself, and it ultimately is more democratic.
Well, I think that Durham certainly has a theme of that right now. There are so many young businesses who have turned to this as a way for funding new projects, and we're all helping each other. I mean, it's your name in terms of Kickstarter. I mean, your name is on a list with a bunch of other people who said, yes, I believe in that. And I think just that that public show of support. You know, it doesn't have to say how much you gave, but just the fact that your name is right there on a list for anyone to see, I think is really important.
My name is on my tax receipt every year. And I'm going to pursue this a little bit longer, because your name is on it. You're invested in the art, and it's a community good. This is the other part of it. Even that art, not as a commodity, but art as a public good, it promotes a creative class. People want to move to Durham. They want to make their businesses in Durham. And all of a sudden, it is good for business, though we haven't commodified the art.
Right. It is about socioeconomic growth. It is about drawing people to downtown Durham. I mean, that has been a part of the mission, is just helping Durham, helping this effort and fueling this energy that's already happening here with what we do in the space. And yeah.
What about art education, though? Now, that's the other side of it. Are
right.
we doing enough to encourage young people, particularly those who may not be able to support themselves in a high quality art education? Are we starting young enough, and is there enough public funding for the arts at the elementary and secondary levels?
I think, that's an issue. Funding for the arts is an issue, for sure. As a space, we're certainly trying to be a resource for anyone to experience what is happening, at least here in Durham. I mean, while we're a donation-run space, we don't require any admission fee. And so anyone is invited to come in and experience what we're seeing at any age. And anyone is also invited to participate by having a show. We have had some exhibits of college students have shown in our space as well. And so, yeah, it's just about being a resource in the best way that we can with the space that we have.
How do you decide what gets in and what doesn't?
Well, like I said, in 2012, it was really just about a conversation with me. I want to see that artists have, you know, a real passion for what they do, and then they have a very clear vision for how they want to execute it, because they have to, because I can't. The CARIC is set up so that, you know, we don't do that for them. We'll promote what they give us, but we don't create that content. We don't create the exhibit for them. So I'm looking for artists with a strong sense of self. I'm looking for people that I feel like I can trust. And so a lot of it was really just intuitive. In 2013, John and I are getting together with rotating groups of past CARIC artists, so artists that have shown with us in the past year, who I think know better than anyone what it really takes to have a show with us, and we're going through proposals together and selecting artists that way.
Do you feel that you need to filter for your taste? In other words, how much does your taste play a part in?
No. I'm looking for a completely diverse range of artistic projects. So I'm thinking about what is going to enrich the conversation that's already happening in Durham, what is going to bring in different groups from the community, how can we facilitate these intersections between groups. So yeah, it's not, I mean, I do have a personal taste, but that I really don't think that colors what we choose.
How about the art scene in the Triangle in general? It does seem to be growing. Lots of art incubators and collaboratives and collectives in Raleigh, Wake County, and as well. And you talked about the Art Center, certainly in Carrboro, Chapel Hill.
It's inspiring. I mean, we have several really great museums. I did an internship at the North Carolina Museum of Art before I started working on the CARIC, and that was so informative. It was such a great experience, and you know, they have a fabulous internship program that I think is educating people constantly on what it means to work in that setting. So we have this great example of an institution in Raleigh, and then we have several smaller museums and commercial galleries, collectives, these incubators. I think it's great, and we all work together. I mean, at the CARIC, I don't feel like we're trying to compete at all with anything that already exists, but just trying to provide some alternative and just participate in the conversation about making people think about how they want to experience art and how they value art.
Yeah, if you talk about the North Carolina Museum of Art, for instance, certainly a very different model, very different goals.
Of course,
right? Obviously, but you think about the number of field trips and kids going to that institution, it's a premier regional, and you know, it even ranks higher than that on the scale. You go to a place like that and you come away thinking, oh, we're about art in this community.
Right. It does feel that way. And there's a tone that's being set throughout the Triangle about that. That is something that I specifically love about Durham. And I think that it probably applies to the other communities in the Triangle as well. But Durham doesn't have this hard set precedent for the way things are supposed to go. There's space for growth right now, and there's so much community support around that. And I don't know that the CARIC, I don't think that we could have started it or that it would have succeeded in the way that it has in any other place.
Yeah, there are really no rules at all.
Yeah, there aren't.
It's sometimes it's frustrating, but often it's just delightful. Mm-hmm. I know you're working with the Durham Art Guild, and you're part of a program called the Creative Mentorship Program. Tell
That's
us
correct.
About that.
Yeah, so I started working with the Durham Art Guild back in August with Katie Size, who's the gallery director there now too. And I've recently sort of shifted away from working in the gallery and more towards education and outreach, which is much more satisfying for me. I get plenty of the gallery stuff with the CARIC. And so I'm working with a program called Student U of Durham. and creating a program called the Creative Mentorship Program, where we're working with five high school students who are part of Student U and five Durham Art Guild artists. And so we've paired them up, and they'll be meeting weekly down at Golden Belt Artist Studios every week until the end of May. And then they'll have a show of student and mentor work in the Room 100 Gallery down there at Golden Belt in June.
You mentioned Golden Belt, and that's another important element in this chain, and mm-hmm. that's a space where artists can affordably work, which I think Golden Belt is still, I'm not sure. That was the model going in anyway.
Golden Belt is an incredible resource for Durham. And it's about that incubator. It's about the conversations that happen. When you put a lot of artists in the same location, and they're all making their own work, and people are coming to see it. I mean, Golden Belt has absolutely become a destination spot in Durham. Then, you know, everybody's growing. Everybody's changing, because it's not this sort of static or sterile art environment. It's this very dynamic thing.
And only people, I mean, by making it relatively affordable space, and again, mm-hmm. I'm assuming it's still that way, it allows fewer barriers for entry. More people can actually participate in this.
Right.
Other than those who could afford to go to the best schools and have themselves gallery space. Mm-hmm. You also curated an exhibit at the National Museum of African Art as part of the Smithsonian?
I was a research assistant to the curator, so I can't take full credit for
Take full credit. Nobody's going to know. They can't hear us in Washington.
But yes, I worked for an independent curator named Kenzie Kochka, who I actually met through my internship at North Carolina Museum of Art. And together, I helped her a lot with the label copy and putting together the catalog and like all that text you see next to all the art in the exhibit. That's what I did at NCMA, and that's what I did for her. So yeah, that exhibit, it's called Revisions, and it's work by a Moroccan artist named Lala Asadi. And yeah, that's at the National Museum of African Art in D.C.
Do you work with your mentees, again, at the elementary or secondary level, on curating exhibits?
I do. All of the kids that I work with, I'm also an art teacher at Happy Mess Art Studio and still at the Art Center. So I do interact with kids on a pretty regular basis. And I sort of mentored a UNC class as well last year, which was so satisfying. So I'm not necessarily asking them to learn how to curate a show, but I am making sure that they're thinking about how it's going to be received, how it's going to be displayed, you know, what needs to be done. Okay, great, you finished your painting, you accomplished what you wanted to on this canvas, but what's next? Because it doesn't stop there. There's much more that needs to be done in terms of helping your public understand your vision.
How about a business model? Is that also part of this? You know, we have the guys from the Beat Making Lab on who go around the world making music,
Piers
Freelon and Apple Juice Kid. And, you know, they made that a big part of the course. How are you going to make a living at this?
Yeah. We certainly at the Carrick want to be an example. I mean, this sort of crowdsourced exhibit space and crowdsource zero commission exhibit space, we want that to be an example for people around the country. And we had the opportunity to sort of talk about that on a much larger scale recently. San Francisco Museum of Modern Art did an interview with us about small scale arts organizations and, you know, the value of us and how we're doing what we do.
Well, that's the interesting part, is that you're actually creating the model as you go. So it's not like learning how to do it and then your PowerPoint presentation
right.
making money at Art 101. It's like, well, no, we're doing this thing. And it's new, relatively new. And as you make the road by walking.
Right.
Doing that. So you're 24 and now you know who you are, right?
No, that's an ongoing.
To the core of your identity.
That's an ongoing process. I know what I love and I'm doing what I love and I'm very happy here. But you know, there's many more adventures to be had.
Well, what about the
adventures
for the Carrick? What's the future? Are you going to stay there over loaf? It smells great.
It smells so good. Yeah. How could I leave those croissants? we'll be there. I hope that we'll be there for a long time. Yeah, and I'll be there.
What about working with kids? Does that have an influence on you? Obviously, you're showing them everything you know, but when you watch their work and listen to their questions, does it change the way you see your job?
Oh, there's so much to be learned from children, especially children who are making art. A lot of that just it's taught me patience. It's reminded me how to stay completely open and fun. I mean, there's no question that a child is afraid to ask. And that it's so important when you're building something new, it's so important to remember that it's okay to ask those questions and to explore sort of uncharted territory. And so, yeah, I definitely get that from my students.
I want to see a Cheerwine installation, only because when we talked about that on the show, I think we had the marketing director on, and he talked about the tiny bubbles, the amount of research that goes in to making the bubbles small. And it stopped me for a moment because I'd never considered that. And I just want to see that. I just want to see that rendered visually.
I do have some wonderful memories. So Carolina Beverage Corporation is in Salisbury, and that's where my dad worked. And when I was a kid, they still did bottling there. They don't do bottling there anymore. That happens in Charlotte. But I do have some great memories of, you know, my dad lifting me up so I could look through the window and watch all the bottles go down the conveyor belt and get their little, you know, cap screwed on and labeled and all this thing. So I do that did sort of create, or that's part of my visual history. So if I ever get back to my own artistic practice, I wouldn't be surprised if some of that cropped up.
I will be looking forward to it. Laura, what a pleasure. So nice to talk with you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Laura Ritchie, co-founder of the Carrick Modern Art in Durham. Next exhibit at the Carrick, Inventories and Observations, a Room of Illustrations by Durham artist Iris Gottlieb, January 29th through February 9th, a reception on February 1st. That's from 6 to 9. And if you didn't get all this down, you can go to carrick.org. Carrick is spelled C-A-R-R-A-C-K, just like the 15th century sailing vessel, carrack.org, for more information. And our website, of course, stateofthings.org. Thank you for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.